nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? First off, did everyone get some special 3D glasses? Not they're up here. So today we are very fortunate to have Mr. Kerry Bernstein here from IBM. He is currently the senior technical staff member at the T.J. Watson Research Center for IBM. He got his bachelor's degree from Washington University in St. Louis, and has a very impressive career, has over 50 patents, has a co-author on three college textbooks. His current research includes areas of high performance and low power advanced circuits technologies, and right now is the PI for IBM's 3D integration.
Good enough, Chad. Good enough, yeah.
I've been going forever.
Thank you, that's fine.
Please, everyone, let's welcome Mr. Bernstein.
Great, thank you. So for those of you that attended the previous lecture, this one's substantially higher, assuming you know a higher database, a higher knowledge base here. So the topic of 3D is really timely and very exciting to me. I have to share with you that when I first started this technology at Watson, when I was first asked to look into it, I thought there was no way on God's green earth that something this stupid was ever going to work. And you know, that was 3 years ago, and we just announced it. IBM just announced this technology. So it really is going to happen, and there's really an application and a need for this technology. So make sure you interrupt me if there are questions. We have an hour, and I limited myself to 3 hours worth of material, so we should be good to go. What we'll do is build the case for 3D. What I should mention, a couple things off the bat, three-dimensional integration really is a whole family of technologies, as you'll see. And the development of 3D integration requires both process development as well as architecture and design development. So I live more in the circuit design, architecture design side, and that'll be what I talk about more. Please interrupt me if there are questions. So, as you'll see, I'm bigoted. Architects really get under my skin, or at least the way that processors have been architected up to now. This is a plot of just data that I've collected from papers that have been presented at ISSCC over the last 10 years, looking at the date of announcement and the amount of area of the processor divided by the performance measured in SPECint 2000. Benchmark. And so you see it's sort of all over the wall, but they tend to go monotonically upward there. And as we mentioned before, the accessible portion of the chip is decreasing generation over generation, which means that you just can't get across die in one cycle anymore. What's making it even worse is that we have deeper pipelines on the processor, means shallower number of stages per cycle. And because of that, the result is that there's just no time to get any work done. And in addition to that, the additional pain in the butt is that we're adding more and more no-ops. We're adding more and more features like registers, muxes, circuits that really perform no logic function but consume power, sort of like my brother-in-law. Get no work out of them at all. And the deal here is that they consume area, they consume power, and they get in the way of really trying to get work done. It makes the chip bigger, it makes the average net length longer. The wire length distribution gets worse because of this overhead that we have to put in. And I'm already on a tangent, but, I'm on a tangent here, but what we find is that these circuits, it tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. There are more and more of these circuits per generation. So it's this notion of span of control. The span of control is essentially, if you were to draw in space, in one or two inverter delays, how far can you get? You know, for instance, in a recent technology, we can perhaps go a certain distance on wire over a period of 9 or 12 picoseconds. So we can get this far. What is the area in space? How many circuits can I contact in that delay, in that amount of time? And that's this notion of area of control. Excuse me. And you can expand that to be as big a number of stages as you wish. But it defines an area that you can access in one or two inverter delays. And the problem is that area is shrinking. In this plot here, I showed this actually in the last lecture, in red circle is one cycle. And over the die as we scale in time. And we see that through about the year 2000, we could get across die in one cycle. But as we continue to create more and more problems, as I mentioned here, it takes 10 or 15 or 20 cycles to get across a single chip. And this is a problem because the way to deal with that then is to add more resource closer to your vector that's within your area of control. And that just makes a bad problem worse because my chip gets bigger and bigger and I have more and more function doing the same job. There are three problems. The wire sucks, the die size sucks, and the number of stages sucks. What happens is that the wires are not getting faster, even though we keep shrinking them. The die size doesn't shrink because we continue to integrate more and more circuits. And the number of FO4 stages has become less. It's not that the stages are getting faster, but there are actually less of them because we're increasing. For those of you that are familiar with the architecture, we're increasing the pipeline depth, which is decreasing the number of stages per cycle. So the three of these things cause a big problem, which is the power, which is this area of control. The plot on the upper right here is if we had 3D, and I know we haven't talked about 3D yet, but just bear with me. If we have 3D and assume it was used in the worst possible case, that we have multiple active layers of silicon and that we can send signals, if we were to assume that in each of these generations that we're actually going up and down every cycle, how much additional area of control can I add by having layers that are vertical instead of lateral? And that's what this plot shows. That, for instance, if we get a very big bang for the buck there, you see the span of control is 1, and we have 20 stages. We can contact another 16 stages by just going to one layer up. And that's assuming the worst case, going up and down between the layers. And we don't do that. So right off the bat, we know that there's this really interesting way of using 3D. The thing, and please interrupt me if there are questions, because there's a lot here, and I want to share with you a lot of stuff. The thing that we'll return to again and again, there are a number of benefits to 3D integration. Everybody and their brother knows about the wire, that you're getting the wire shorter, because instead of going XY, instead of just having to go in the XY dimension, we have the Z dimension, and that shortens the average wire length distribution. But there's more to it. There's way more to it. And I'm very proud of my company because it took a lot of nerve to invest in this technology and to go do it. And it's done. And it's so damn exciting. It works. What we will return to, and you know, I'll say the conclusion now at the very beginning of the talk and we'll return to it. The most important contribution that this technology offers the microelectronics industry is bandwidth and latency. We'll explain those terms in a little while. Bandwidth and latency, the two most important contributions. So 3D has been in the news like crazy. You know, lately all you hear about is 3D integration this, 3D integration that. You know, why is it that suddenly this is getting so popular? Well, it's that there really is not a lot left. You know, there's not a lot of other directions left for us to go to improve latency. So as we'll talk more about this later, but 3D means a lot of stuff. You know, in general, 3D means that we go in the Z direction as well as the XY direction, but we've been doing it for a while. And there's a lot of ways of doing it. You know, clearly you could argue that cell phone technology, doing just stacked 3D chips and wire bonds in order to reduce the form factor, you can call that 3D. Doing flip chips, where you actually mount one chip on top of another with solder balls, you know, clearly that's 3D. What I'm really interested in is the home run, the upper right corner. the true 3D integration. I actually brought a wafer with me. I'll have to show you. What this means is that we're interested in bonding whole wafers. After processing, stacking whole processed wafers that are specially prepared and putting vertical vias through the wafers. That is where I think the real home run is. The technology, we have to grow into it, as you'll see in a moment. Again, 3D integration really means a whole family of technologies. At the very low end, and what differentiates these technologies is not whether they're bond, whether, you know, when all is said and done at the end of the day, they're chips. They're just plain chips. The chips might have been known good die that you diced separately and then stacked, or you might bond whole wafers and then dice it up. Doesn't matter. What matters is the size of the vertical via and how many of them you have. So when all is said and done, that's all it is. And you see there's a whole range of sizes, of diameters of the via, and in fact, how many of them you use on chip. And the more you get, the more you have the ability, the more powerful the application can become, to the point where you can actually build a 3D multi-core processor if you have the vias. So a few rather sensitive numbers that I'll share with you. Presently, the normal two-dimensional chips have perhaps 10,000 I/O. Each I/O is a C4 ball that's it's a solder ball that's 3 mils in diameter. The best known good die chip stack technologies right now have vertical vias of about 50 micron diameter. My research team ultimately, and it looks very good that we'll get there, research team will ultimately get to less than 1 micron diameter vias, well under 1 micron, measured in nanometers. And the most exciting piece of this is, you know, the number of vias is related to how fat they are. If you can get the layers thinner, then you get more then the vias have a smaller diameter, and you can get more of those vias on chip. As I mentioned, right now we have 10,000 I/O. With the technology, it looks quite feasible we'll get more than 1 million I/O. So conservatively, we will get 3 decades more I/O on the chip. And you say, yeah, 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 Carrie, so what? It's a big so what, because the bandwidth associated, the memory bandwidth associated with that much I/O is staggering. It says on the fly you can change context. Even more than that, it suggests that you can actually do virtual applications. You won't need Excel installed on your laptop anymore. You won't need Microsoft Office installed. If you need it, you just instantaneously download it. The memory is that wide. So there's certainly alternatives to 3D integration, and they stink, to tell you that I'm bigoted, but they stink. There's this notion of multi-chip modules that are in silicon carriers. It's a good start, and it's sort of the beginning of microprocessing. There's this notion of SoC, a system on a chip, where you integrate the functions onto a chip. Problem is the die is still big, and the yield is difficult. The silicon in package is really where we start to, number three there, is where we really start to deal with the true notion of 3D integration, where the die are stacked, but they're known good die. You test them separately, you make sure the die work, and then you stack them and hope that they function. And then finally, the most exciting one is the one that integrates a bunch of different technologies, actives and passives, and forms this notion of silicon on package. Are there questions? Okay, please stop me if there are. When one looks at a design roadmap such as this going forward in time, it becomes very obvious that 3D has been waiting and that there's this gap. You know, up on the top plot there are the bumps that are associated with the connectivity for chip to module. On the lower plot here, the green, yellow, and black dots in the lower curves, that's the multi-level wiring pitches, the design rule for the wires. And you notice there's this big space in between. So it just figures, you know, it's just as natural as can be that if you want a continuous integration, you got to fill that gap. Because the chip is at these dimensions, the upper dimensions is, the macros are at the lower dimensions, and the chip is at the upper dimensions, so you really need something in between. There have been a number of interconnect schemes that have been proposed. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these. Wire bonding has been around longer than God. So you're familiar with that. There's this notion of microbump technology. This comes from North Carolina State, but it is the notion where there are microbumps and you stack chips. It's used a little bit in cell phones. And then the true 3D integration. So among 3D integration, there's the notion of coupling virtual interconnects. You know, and they say, yeah, it's nice because if the chip doesn't work, you have no pins and you don't have to reflow the solder. I'm not so impressed. The idea is inductively or capacitively, you couple signals up and down. Well, this is to be frank, this is a pain in the ass because then you got all these, you got electromagnetic interference that they're creating. You have alignment issues that you have to deal with. You have the area and the power associated with these fairly large inductors. It's not all fancy. What we're going to spend today's talk on is this, the through-via technology. Through-via technology is where we thin the layers to make the vias. Remember, the diameter of the via is related to the thickness of the silicon. By thinning the layers, I can make a smaller diameter. And since I have a smaller diameter, I can have more of them. And remember, our goal is to get under 1 micron. We'll actually get well under 1 micron before it's all said and done. Questions? Okay. 3D has got a ton of really cool uses. Again, I'm probably preaching to the choir because I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but bandwidth and latency, very exciting. Heterogeneity, the ability to combine technologies that don't usually play well together. Good examples like RF, putting silicon germanium RF on top of high-speed CMOS. Power supply conditionings, there's a cool one. Excuse me, actually putting the power supply, a dedicated power supply, above each core in a multi-core processor. You can turn the cores on and off. What a cool idea. I/O formatting, if you have a chip that comes out in PCI format, you want it in you want PCX bus, whatever you want, you can convert with a separate conversion layer, a profile layer. Reusable IP, you're familiar with ASICs? Well, you can do ASICs in 3D as well as in 2D. There's no reason you can't assemble chips on the fly that way. And the most promising things, the lowest hanging fruit, is the use of memory, redundancy, and managing temperature. So, it's useful to go back in time, in history, and look at, this is actual trend taken from our power series, IBM server series. And what it's looking at is the performance that we achieved in each of these server processors. And this is our big gun. These are our big guns. It's taken IBM's highest-end processors and the performance they achieved. And look at all the god-awful junk that we had to do to achieve that performance. And you'll have to take my word for it. This is painful. You know, by the time we were getting to Power 4, Power 4 Plus, we were doing out-of-order execution. We were doing speculative execution. This stinks. Out-of-order, for those of you not familiar with it, means that I snoop the incoming instruction stream. I disassemble the instruction, figure out what it needs, and I reorder the instructions to keep all my resources on chip consumed so I get as much done as possible. But what this means is that the instructions are no longer in order. They have to be, the intermediate output has to be retained and reordered after execution. It's a logistical nightmare, but it's overhead that we've needed that the architects have foisted upon us to continue to improve performance. Speculative execution, it's the same pain. The notion with speculative execution, I might need that instruction. Go simulate it. Oh, by the way, you're going to need an extra execution unit. I'm going to need extra machine state registers. It's going to need its own dedicated on-chip bus. Who cares? We need it. So you can see how things blow up very quickly. Finally, people said, enough is enough. We're going back to single issue, single threaded, in order processors. And those are the cores that form multi-core processors nowadays. And when we go to 8, 16, 32 core processors, they will all be single threaded. Most of them will be single threaded inline execution engines. What's true of all of these, though, is as we continue adding more and more painful stuff, what happens is that the amount of energy, not just power, but the amount of energy we spend on moving the data exceeds the amount of energy that we use moving the data actually exceeds the amount of power that we spent generating the data. As a matter of fact, there was, I think that's got to stay open. No, I think it needs to be wedged open. So there's been a lot of work on this, and there's a projection. I forget how many years out. It is anticipated, and this is an unbelievable piece of data, but it's projected, and I think it's within 10 or 15 years, as a nation, we will spend more energy moving data than moving matter. And that includes all the railroad cars, all the trucks on the road. I mean, it's really an unbelievable number, but I've seen that defended a number of times. So the notion is here, we continue, if you leave performance to architects, God help you, you can see what it's going to do to us. And so the notion is that by the time we go to power, by the time we went to Power 5 and Power 5 Plus, the result is we needed massive amounts of bandwidth to sustain some of these architectural tricks. Bandwidth that's just no longer available. And I'll show you that here. This is a plot on the memory wall. Many of you are probably familiar with the memory wall. The memory wall just means that you can put as much processor horsepower on a chip as you like, but if you don't keep them fed, they're like my teenage son. If you don't keep it fed, you know, it's just going to sort of run out of steam and sit there. So the notion here is that they have huge appetites. You can see on the upper plot, the CPU speed has continued to climb exponentially with scaling, but the memory speed is not. So it suggests, okay, so the memory speed has not increased, so we just need to add more memory, or we need to increase the processor bus speed, the ratio of the memory bus to the processor bus. But that hasn't happened either. So what's happening is that we're heading for this memory wall where we can't get data to the processor. The other problem is this one of bandwidth. And I'll return to the numbers that I discussed earlier. The issue with bandwidth is that the C4s, the pads that we use presently to bring signals in chip, as we continue to add cores on our multi-chip process, on our multi-core processors, they all have this appetite for data, and they'll need separate signals brought in. But unfortunately, and if we look at scaling theory, just simple CMOS scaling, the plot in black says, yeah, no problem. It's really hard, but we think we know how to continue shrinking things, at least for a little while. And that's the plot in black. However, if we look at the plot, if we look at these lines here, what that says is, just from an I/O constraint point of view, we can't do it. So it says that this I/O wall is sort of like the memory wall coming at us, but a new way. It's really a painful thing. So let's get down to brass tacks here. I warned you this one wouldn't be as fluffy as the last presentation. Let's look at processor trying to get its work done. The processor is represented by the blocks on the left, and the delay is on the right. So we have a processor with an execution and an instruction unit. It's got a lonely little cache there, and the cache is responsible for keeping the E unit busy. If we suffer a miss, which means the execution unit needs some data that does not exist in the cache, it's got to go back up to L2 cache or to main store to go get that data. And if the data you need is not in L2 but in L3 or in main store, God help you, because you're going to suffer a machine stall unless you can keep it busy doing something else. I mean, I know this sounds pathetic, but this is the way I've made my living for 30 years. So the problem then is that we want to keep miss rates as low as possible. We never want to make we want to keep the processor busy working, which means I always got to keep it full of work. In red, the E busy, that is the delay. The y-axis on the right plot is cycles per instruction. We want that number to be as low as possible. We want to use as few cycles as possible to retire a transaction. Okay? So MIPS, the number of million instructions per second, is the inverse. It's proportional to the inverse of this number. So in red, the execution unit, this is the delay if the execution unit full tilt. It's got everything it needs. Leave me alone. I'm busy. I'm working. I'm not listening. I got everything I need. In blue is the fact that the E unit needs data, but thank God it came from the L1 cache. I didn't have to go any farther than the L1 cache. That's the blue line, and it assumes the cache is infinitely big. Every time I need data, it's there waiting for me. Sort of like your mother, you know, lunch is here. But unfortunately, we suffer misses. And as you increase, as the miss rate increases, the actual delay is represented by the green line. The green line is the fact that the cache is not infinite, like my teenage son believes. Cache is finite. There's a finite amount of cache. And it increases as, and so the delay, as the miss rate increases, the performance of the processor slows down. And this would be fine if we don't suffer misses. Oh, darn, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. Okay. So we're going to get to the miss rate in a minute. But just, again, to review, I don't want to hit you over the head with this, but I want to hit you over the head with this. The processor has its L1 above, and this is how a miss is retired. Processor says, I need data. L1 says, sorry, I don't got it. Flag number one goes up, says, I got a miss. So it goes up to L2. There's a time of flight on that gray arrow on the left. It goes up to the L2, and it says, I need this data. The L2 cache says, you wait your turn. There's a lot of other people that want data here, too. So it waits its turn. It gets prioritized. It finally gets the data. In step number four, the cache says, all right, give me your number. What data do you need? You give it an address, and the data it needs might be in many, many lines. And it starts, the lines start downloading. You might need a dozen lines, you might need four lines, depending on the length, the number, the block size that you need. It comes down on a railroad track. I wish it was like six parallel railroad tracks, but it's one railroad track, maybe two if you're lucky. And once you start that data coming down, sorry, Charlie, you know, you say, stop, I got what I need. You can stop now. You get in the whole stinking train. That whole fetch is coming. And nobody else can get on that bus until the fetch is done. So God help you if you fetch too much data or the wrong data, because you got to wait till it all comes. So the data comes down, you see there. Step number six, before it can get off the train, you got the Federal Bureau of Data Investigation. And it's got to do error correction coding and make sure that the data that's getting off the train is clean. So it does ECC. It might be Hamming code. It might be gray code. It might be simple parity. Whatever, it's going to get checked. And then it can put its shoes back on and put its change back in his pocket and get off the airplane and go back into L1, which says, come on in, you got your data. This sucks. Now, this wouldn't be so bad if you didn't have a high miss rate. But this is data from a real IBM processor. I can't tell you which processor it is, although it was in all the Apple computers. And it begins with power and it ends with PC. But I can't tell you what processor it is. This is looking at the distance between misses. How many instructions I can run before I incur a miss. This is a histogram. Life would be like grand if it was this way. But it's not. It says I can't run more than 5 or 10 instructions and I'm going to have to wait on a miss. And it's quite a dent, as you can see. So the moral to the story is misses really dominate microprocessor performance. And the microprocessor that retires misses most effectively is the winner at the end of the game, at the end of the show. So let's talk more about what happens to a miss. Do you remember I was just talking about there's only one or two railroad tracks coming in? Yeah.
Zero.
Context change. That is recording the frequency of context changes when the processor has to switch modes. When it has a whole, what's known as a whole new congruence class. And so because this is a histogram, it's quite often the microprocessor has to change complete congruence classes, which means the complete contents of the microprocessor are invalid, and they have to be completely dumped. Most of the time, sir, we count on the fact that we don't have to completely change the context. We only need to augment it or use the least recently used data. We can dump the least recently used data. But every now and then, we suffer these massive changes of function of the processor. And that's what that is. Thanks for asking. Other questions? Okay. So, here we go. If you don't, you know, I had this professor in college. He had a red hat and a blue hat, a grad professor. If it was something that you could go to sleep on, it wasn't going to be on the test, he'd have a blue hat on. If it was something that it was critical, you understood it, and it was going to be on the test, he'd put on the red hat. So I promise, you know, I know it's 3:30 late on a Thursday afternoon. Not too many red hat topics, I promise, but this is one. This is key to the whole concept here. As I mentioned to you, the two big things that 3D will bring us, and if you didn't figure it out, 3D is going to be really useful in memory. So the two big things that 3D is useful for is latency and bandwidth. We've talked about latency already, the miss. But how about the bandwidth? How about the bandwidth? So what happens here is that, as I mentioned to you, I only have two railroad tracks that lead me from my L2 cache into the microprocessor, right? Now, if the railroad tracks are busy with a train coming into the station dumping data, the station is occupied. I can't get a new train into that station until I got the old one out, right? So it follows then that the miss rate is not only going to be affected by how often I miss, but the length of the train, how many cars are on that train. And what's been missed in the industry, and to tell you the truth, one reason I'm really proud of IBM's work, what we discovered with a lot of modeling and actually a lot of expense is that what affects performance is not the leading edge. You know, when we talk about the miss effect, the miss rate affecting performance, it's not how quick I get the first data in, it's how quick I can get that stinking train out of the station. So you can say, okay, Kerry, I'll fix that. I'll just make all the train cars this big. Well, fine, but your address space to address train cars this big exploded, and your on-chip address array is going to explode. That's not a solution. And I'm just going to need more cars anyway in a lot of the cases. So I size the train cars effectively, but even so, I'm stuck by the trailing edge of data. The trailing edge defines my performance, not the leading edge. That's actually a pretty important, that's a pretty effective thing because it defines this notion of bus utilization. How busy is my bus? Questions? I want to make sure that's clear to everybody. So just to the background information, the hyperlink here that I'll click on is that there are two kinds of microprocessors in this world. There are scientific machines and there are commercial machines. The scientific machines, which is most of what all of us in this room use, work on streaming workloads. Very predictable workload, like your Unix box, tons of data. You're doing the same operation on tons of data all the time, little to no misses. The bus utilization can be 100%. Keep that stinking bus busy and keep it full. Just keep bringing the data in for me. It's good. But in the other world, in the commercial applications, you know, the guys with the silk ties and the wingtip, the pointy shoes and stuff, those guys, they need very available buses. Because the cashier at Starbucks, she might be ringing up a sale one moment, and then the next moment her manager comes in and says, give me an inventory. How have we done the last week? The processor in that cash register on the fly has to instantly change and go do something else. And so the bus has to be available for that. And because of that, this notion of bus utilization is absolutely critical. That's why this is really valuable. I just want to make the point, this is one of those things that I don't know why it works, but it works. It's one of those deals. And please, if you don't, this is sort of like somewhere between red and blue, so stick with me. In blue is the bus utilization. And this is sort of intuitive. Independent of the number of instructions per miss, independent of that, Wouldn't it make sense to you that as the bus gets busier, your performance goes to hell? This is real data coming off of trace from our high-end machines, our server machines, actually one used in air traffic control. And it shows that cycles per instruction, it peaks at 3.6 cycles per instruction, and it really begins to crash as the bus gets busier and busier. And you know why now. You guys know the secret to this. It's because the bus is full. I can't get the data to the processor to go do it. The bus is too busy. And so as a rule of thumb, at least at IBM, we like to stay at bus utilizations that really don't go above 25 or 30%. And it's completely empirical. It just, you know, I suspect you could do some derivation, but who cares? We got the data that says that's the way it should go. So this is sort of like one of those, this ought to, if I haven't hit you over the head with this, the only point I want to make here is that microprocessors are limited by both latency and bandwidth. Latency just means the delay in getting the work done. Remember the red line, the E-unit line? That's just the delay in getting the work done. And that doesn't matter how many cores you got. There's this fundamental delay. As I add cores, if I have 2 cores or 4 cores or 8 cores, the green line goes to the blue line, goes to the red line. And they will saturate at some performance, assuming you kept these teenagers fed. If you don't keep them fed, they start to roll off, as you see on the left there. So my only point is that bandwidth is important, but latency is important also. And you can see the black line there showing the curve of how much bandwidth you need to provide each core in a 2-core, in a 1-core, 2-core, or 4-core processor. Any questions? Okay. So this is sort of a fun aside, but it's one of those things I couldn't help it. My boss was off my back for a day. It struck me that there must be an analogy to skyscrapers. You know, skyscrapers are sort of expensive to build, right? And you only build them when real estate gets very, very expensive. And so it would follow that when rents get really bad, the rate of building of skyscrapers would increase. So I took the same software that we use for modeling performance in microprocessors, and IBM's got this division, a real estate division, and I bugged the hell out of these people. They were getting so sick of me, but you know, I would hear the lady say in a real thick New York accent, "Oh, God, it's that geek from research calling again." And I'd hear her manager saying, "You got to talk to them. We're their contractors." You know, she said, "Okay, what do you want? What do you want?" And I'd say, "Well, I want the skyscraper, you know, the rents per square foot in Manhattan from this year to this year." So finally, they gave me this data. And it's true. It's sort of fun, but it's the same analogy. It's just when real estate gets very expensive, then people start building skyscrapers. I should mention, and it's sort of sad, you see the dip between 2000 and 2002. That's 9/11. And it really had quite an effect on the total number of, you can see the dent in the number of square feet in New York office space and what it did to rent. You know, business just went to hell. And sort of a graphic example of a tough time. So this is where I get to do my hand waving. And I used some special software here called HandJob to make this plot. So, all right, so this is all normalized data and arbitrary units. But, you know, device technology has continued to improve, but it's, as you know, because of scaling, it's rolling off. Interconnect performance just leveled off a long time ago, and the best we do is improve density. The best we do is keep interconnect performance constant, but we don't. You know, it's actually rolling off a little bit. But that's rolled off a long time ago. So it's no coincidence that as interconnect performance quit and the time of flight across these big chips increased, that we started increasing the number of microprocessors per core. That's all well and good. And through it all, you see the black line, we continue to extend system performance. But you remember that plot I showed you with the I.O., that we were stuck in the number I.O.? That's this. I.O. sticks us that at some point we run out of I.O. to feed these monsters. At that point, we got a decision to make. If we don't go 3D, it levels off. If we do go 3D, we continue to extend that black line until we hit the next calamity that my appraisal will be based upon. So, to the implementation side. I think I'll probably stop here. To the implementation side, we have a ton of stuff. You know, our industry has invested billions of dollars on engineering design automation, test pattern generation, ground rule checking, placement, wiring, test, I can go on and on. And until we, and if you can use that infrastructure to a new technology, you got it made. And that's, in fact, what we want to do. But the key is, where do you use this? It's a secret weapon. Where do you use this? You certainly don't want to use it at the transistor level, because I'd have vias coming out my ears, and they'd be causing wire blockages and all kinds of. So we don't want to do it here. And I don't want to do it out here either, because if I have these wonderful vertical vias, but I never use them, it's a waste of money. So the answer is, at the unit level, like fixed point, floating point, storage control unit, somewhere between there and at the macro level, adders, rotators, multipliers, somewhere in there looks like the very most effective use of this thing. And a little piece of sensitive information, about 10% blockages is what we think we can stand caused by the 3D, because it's passing through the chip. We talked about this already. As I mentioned before, we really don't have any alternatives right now. So it begs this question, you know, we might as well do it, because we, 3DI, after CMOS, there's really no technology as mature or as well developed. One of the challenges, are there questions? Okay. One of the challenges is these things get hot. And as you know, the volume increases as the cube and the area is the square. And as the number of circuits increases, we better manage power. So it suggests that when we start stacking chips, we want to operate them in parallel. One of the tricks is that if you slow a processor down, you can run it at lower voltage. You know, if you run a processor at lower voltage, it's going to slow down. But if I can add a ton more processors, maybe with parallelism, I can recapture or improve upon that performance. So that's the goal. But the problem is that as cavemen, all of us sort of evolved as uniprocessors. You know, I stick my hand in the fire, I burn my finger, I ain't going to do that no more. You know, uniprocessor, caveman thought. Unfortunately, only the Borg and ants know how to think in parallel. The rest of us tend to still, by evolution, tend to think on our own. So sadly, there are very few single-threaded instructions that we know how to divvy up into multiple processors. Very few. When we do, this is here waiting for us. But until then, we're going to have to wait for the Borg to assimilate us. I promised I'd talk a little bit about wire length distribution, and I just want to skim over this very quickly. This is an analysis that was done on the PowerPC processor, just looking at the value of more buffers and shorter wire lengths. And as you guessed, you know, the short answer to a long story is that when you shorten the wires, you not only save the power and the performance of the wire and the delay of the wires, but you also save the number of buffers. And that's what the plot there shows. So let's get to the interesting stuff. I want to get some hardware out to show you. If I brought it. Yes. Okay. So as I mentioned to you, we are going to stick, the thing of greatest interest is bonding wafers. If it's of value, why don't I just very quickly describe how the process works. This is the process that we're actually working on for new product. Let's assume that we want to build a two-chip stack. Okay? We want to build a two-chip stack, and circuit layer one is going to be the upper layer. Circuit layer 2 is going to be the lower layer. So I fabricate each of these chips completely conventionally and completely normally, with one exception. This chip, I stop before I add any metals onto it. Circuit layer 2, before I put the thing on top of it, has all the metallization it wants. Now, one of the problems, people say, well, Kerry, why the hell don't you just deposit another layer of silicon and go implant the devices and build it all at once? You can't, because you raise the temperature of the other chip underneath it. And when you do, you start to out-diffuse the source drain implants, and it completely balls up the chip underneath. Can't do it. So they really, for our purposes, they need to be fabricated separately. So we fabricate layer one, layer two. We glue layer one, which is going to be on top. We glue a piece of glass to it. We stop before metals, glue a piece of glass to it, flip it upside down, and do a gross process with toothpaste called chemic polish, chemical mechanical polishing. And we remove that gray layer that says circuit layer one. These are SOI wafers. And I will have to talk some time about SOI. That was a whole separate. But this is one case where it really paid off for us to have invested in SOI. So we bury, we polish the chip all the way down to the buried oxide layer in SOI, flip it back over, align it to the layer underneath. And this is almost like one of those things, like, you know, like stickers. If you put a sticker on a piece of paper, once you touch it, it's done. The van der Waals force with silicon dioxide is so strong, once you touch it, it's done. Nonetheless, to get good bonding, it's at high pressure, low temperature though, but very high pressure to get good bonding. We bond it. After it's bonded, we use either a laser raster or a water pick, actually very similar to the tooth thing, the water pick thing, and dissolve its laser ablatable adhesive or its water soluble adhesive. We dissolve the glue and remove the glass handle wafer. What we're left with is the assembly on the right, but without the vertical via. So then we just have a selective etch that etches down and makes the contact. So what I want to show you, this is actually a historic wafer. This is the first one of ours that actually worked. This is a 200 millimeter wafer, and it looks normal, except, can you see through it? This is less than 2 microns in thickness. I mean, it's probably 100 times thinner than a normal wafer, and this has the glass handle on it. So this is that circuit layer one just before the glass got taken off. This is that middle photo. And the process, so again, the reason that this technology is successful is because we're using processes that we already know how to do. We're doing bonding, which you just talked about. We did transfer and alignment of this layer. And the alignment's sort of cool. Since you can see through it, you can do box in box the same way we align masks, because it's so transparent. I mean, this thing is so flexible. It just, you can bend it. It's that thin. We do electrical contacting. And then the release process, the process by which we get the glass off this stinker without screwing up the stuff underneath it. There questions? So again, there's Catherine Guarini's hand and our first yielding 3D wafer there. And it's been announced, and we're applying it to a number of different technologies soon. So, time to put on the glasses. This is a fun one. Red on the left. Here we go. So what we're going to look at, this is a fly-through of the design data from a 3D chip. What you're going to see is we're going to fly through a static memory. Oh, God. You know, it's so much fun to make so many intelligent people look stupid. You ought to see you guys. Everybody put on their glasses here. I promise I'll mail this back to you guys. Maybe I'll mail it to, like, the professor or something. All right, everybody on there. Oh, God, is that great. Okay. And you guys look stupid. This is great. I know you're not, though. Okay, so this is a memory. It's a 3D static RAM. A static RAM is on top of a microprocessor. We're flying in vertically from the top. You're going to fly through the metallization. You're going to fly through the silicon of the second layer, through the vertical via, into the microprocessor down below. Okay? And it goes quick. And it's also, I use this to complain to my manager that I need a higher power processor. Okay. I hope this works. Projectors all act the same. So we're back through metal 4, metal 3, via layer, metal 2 just went by. I have to get my perspective metal one. We're into the front end of line, just passed by the poly. We're entering diffusion, just went by. You can see the octagons of the vertical vias to the layer below. Here come the octagons and our guard edge seal. We're through the octagons. Now we're in the microprocessor, and you can see how much denser the microprocessor is. Here's where I tell my boss I need a more powerful laptop because it's jerking around. But now we're through the metallization, 7 layers of metallization. They go through here pretty quick, vertical vias. The dense stuff is, that was the metal 1 via. Here's the poly, the contact to it, poly, CA layer, diffusions passing through, and the light target there was the end of the simulation. So I don't know if the 3D works. Did it work here? Is it effective? Okay. Sometimes the projector is... Okay. So just one. I just want to stop on just talking a little bit more about heat. You know, there's a reason why popcorn explodes and why 16-valve engines don't last too long and why dinosaurs are dead. And it goes back to this notion of the cube of the dimension rather than the square of the dimension. And 3D is the same. So as you can bet, a very big part of our announcement process was modeling the thermals. And the biggest challenge, I don't want to keep you, but the biggest challenge was putting the where to, which order to stack the cores and the memory. Memory is very low power density. Cores are very high power density. Put the cores near the heat sink. Very nice. You keep the core the lowest temperature. But the problem is then it's got to come out this end and has a lot of electrical impedance passing through the rest. Is it slower that way? Or is it slower the opposite way, which is this? Put the memory up near the top and the core is really fast electrically, but the thermal conductivity is terrible. Show of hands. Who thinks the one on the left is the answer? Who thinks the one on the right is the answer? So it sounds like the majority of people think this is the answer. God, put those glasses back on. You look smarter then. The answer is the one on the left. Don't you dare let the processor get hot. The impedance associated with the vertical via is nowhere near as damaging as the delay caused by the processor getting hot and slowing down. So our chips are built the way on the left there, and there's just been a lot of thermal modeling. Another challenge is that now chips have to be built in SOI, at least everything above the first layer. So SOI's got a lot of baggage associated with it, the floating body effect, the parasitic bipolar response. It's not undoable. It's not impossible. It just has to be done carefully. So there's a lot of challenges, but there's a lot to be paid for. There's a lot of payback for doing it. So this is a good place to stop. We are up against atomistic as well as quantum mechanical limitations that really don't allow us to improve as dramatically the performance as we used to. It's time for really a new home run. Integration into the Z-plane using vertical vias. It's funny, they call those Zias now. Vertical vias in the Z direction, they call them Zias. Those postpone some of the interconnect-related problems, again, for a while. And you know, we've injected tons of money and time. We've had to go to copper. When copper ran out of steam, we had to add copper and low-k dielectric. When the back end of the line just keeps at us. It's like a pest. You know, just we can't seem to get away from the challenges that it creates. Our devices, like FinFETs, are no longer 2D, so why the hell not that package? Let's just make the whole stinking thing 3D and call it a day. We mentioned that the transaction retirement rate dependence is getting more and more on data delivery than on the speed of the processor. So we better improve the data delivery. We better concentrate on that more so than the processor. The storage density thing, I hope we made pretty clear, is already really important. And the last big challenge then is making sure that we try to save power in the delivery of data, since that's where most of the performance goes. I like using this because it's sort of like, you know, our tools want to make microprocessor design 2D, even though it's really 3D. So it sort of evokes this notion from Escher. So that's all I got. Thank you very much for listening.
Any questions?
I might not be able to answer everything, but yeah.
Showed that the memory is stacked on top of the cores. Do you stack cores as well, or just cores?
Yeah, you can. What we found is that the thermal management is critical. So if you have a means of reducing the power density in the thermal cores, you're golden. Stacking memory on processor, pretty easy because the power density is so low in the memories. So presently it's very challenging, though, with the kind of power densities we see in high-performance computing in HPC to stack cores. The solutions are more expensive. They use microfluidics, or they use Peltier devices or CBEC devices. Very expensive, and it's not clear it's worth it. But you're exactly right. That is the goal. And if you can operate them at low voltage, you're good. And that's why that's why my research program right now is concentrating on how to run things at low voltage and still get the throughput. More questions? Yeah?
So what about this optical interconnect business? Are you guys looking into that?
We are. And optical is very attractive. You know, photonics in general is a very growing field, but not in this case. The challenge with, if you did put a signal on an optical carrier, it'd be very fast. Excuse me, but then what you do incur is the conversion back to the electronic. We're still doing calculations. We're still doing our signal processing and our logic evaluation using MOSFETs. So you have to pay for the area and the power, as well as the conversion space for the transducer that takes you from the optical back to the. But yeah, that's a very popular area. Optics are used in the system, you know, when you get out of the chip, but at the chip level, not yet. Yeah.
It seems that HiK added one or two more generations.
Ooh, that's a good question. So how many generations? I don't know. That's a fair question. It certainly adds, one of the challenges, I guess I'll answer it with another question. Every time we add something to these processes, you're stuck with it. Like we added copper, and it wasn't the easiest thing because we did it via Damascene. So we added copper, and now all our chips have to have copper. And we added low-k inner dielectrics. Now all of our chips have copper and low-k dielectrics, and it's still not good enough. So we're going to add this. We're going to add 3D integration, which is expensive and uses interposers, and we're going to have some yield issues associated with it. And then I'm going to have copper and low-k and 3D. I mean, it's sort of like a chain letter, So it at least adds at least a generation because the factor was about 1.62. Yeah, we can do it that way. Factor is 1.62. We get 30%. We get a 25% scale factor. So in two generations, we'll use it up. So I guess the answer is it's worth two generations. Good question.
So how bad is the yield issue?
The yield issue? So the question is, how bad is the yield issue? It's bad, but not bad enough. Yield is a very sensitive proprietary topic. But what I can tell you is this. We know with 3D that we can eliminate some wiring levels. And wire is our biggest yield detractor. So, 3D has a yield issue because now we're going to suffer yield fallout due to the vertical via not going in right. But on the other hand, we're not suffering the yield dent that we take from the two layers of metal that we might be able to get out of the chip now. So it's neutral. We hope that it'll be neutral. All of our technologies have a learning curve, and the company sometimes has patience with us and allows us to start a little higher, and then we ramp into a better place than we had been. But IBM's rule to me and to my buddies is that any technology we introduce has to improve performance, reduce cost, and yield better than the technology before it. And it's like, okay, we'll do it. Yeah, it's hard, but we think it'll get there. More questions? Yeah. So the question is, in a multi-core processor, are they all in the same layer or on different layers? So this is sort of related to the question before, is can we do more than one layer of multi-core processor? With the present configuration, our policy is not to discuss unannounced product, but the only feasible way to build 3D integration at this point is to do And again, I'm talking about HPC. So for HPC applications, the only feasible technique right now is to put all the cores in one layer. Now, all bets are off if we can run them at lower frequency and or lower voltage. Then you can get away with more. But this cooling thing is a challenge, you know, keeping them cool. Yeah?
One last question.
Sure.
We have heard that the cores are the hot spot, that the memory doesn't see too much heat.
Yeah.
But now in this technology, memory is going to see all the heat. So this is going to affect the reliability of memory.
Ooh. So the question is that the question is that memories are fairly low power density, but processors are high power density, but the memories never used to see this heat, and now they do. So the answer to your question, rather roundabout, is that is the heat isotropic or anisotropic? If it's all at the same temperature, you have new issues to deal with, but they're all the same. But if I have hot spots on my core and it's laying on top of hot spots, I've created differentials. Differentials are bad. But if I can smooth it out, or if I can do my placement carefully so that the heat is quite quite uniform, I'm golden. Because the array will be hotter, it'll leak more, my switch points might not be as good, my transfer ratios might change, but they're all the same. And they all move the same. So, more questions? Okay, the thing I want to make sure that I mention, you know, coming and talking to you guys is really a privilege to me, and, you know, to be able to help provide insight to your education and your careers. I think it's like one of the most important things I do. So I have a bunch of business cards, and also Chad can provide you with my email address if you don't get one. But if you have questions about your career, or if there are, you know, if there are guidance, there are mentoring kinds of issues, or research or school decisions or job decisions, if there's any input. I've been at IBM 30 years, and the industry's changed a lot, but I think engineering's still a really good way to make a living, and if I can help you in any of your decisions, please make sure you get a hold of me.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bernstein, again.